In association with Newsarama, welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. On this edition of Word Balloon, we sit down with TV and film writer Christos Gage to talk about his current comics work. There's a lot out there. World War Hulk tie-ins with the X-Men and Iron Man. His Wildstorm work, including the ongoing series Stormwatch PhD, drawn by Doug Mankey, and upcoming new miniseries Armageddon, and details on the Authority Prime miniseries. We'll also look at future projects for Chris, like House of M Avengers with his co-collaborator Mike Perkins. And for Dynamite Entertainment, Chris will be writing new adventures of the spaghetti western hero, the Man with No Name. This episode of Word Balloon is sponsored by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you've liked them before, check them out today. They've got all new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic book and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% or more. For all the details, go to mailordercomics.com. Dude, you're like doing a million things, and this is great.
I am very busy. Yeah, can't complain. I'm very happy about that.
All right, we got World War Hulk X-Men.
World War Hulk X-Men number 2 came out today.
Right.
We got Annihilation Quasar. Iron Man number 20 comes out, I think, next week. We've got Stormwatch. The trade paperback came out today of the first arc. Those, I believe, are the ones that are currently running. Then, let's see, what month is this? July. In September, I did a story, a Nightmare on Elm Street story for the New Line horror anthology from Wildstorm.
Cool. You like how I'm making you do all the work? All right, I'll keep firing off some ones. House of M 1979 Avengers.
House of M Avengers, yep. That is November.
The news last week, The Man with No Name for Dynamite?
Man with No Name, yeah, that's the big news.
And when is that going to be coming out?
Winter, we're saying November, December, thereabouts.
Okay.
We don't want to pin it down just yet because we don't want to disappoint anybody, but it won't be, it'll be around there.
Very cool. Well, let's talk about what's going on now. I just put down World War Hulk X-Men, and a great individual issue where a lot happens. But, you know, the continuation will go on to the third issue. But
right.
I've enjoyed both issues so far. And doing continuity implants like that, is it, you know, par for the course because you're used to it from TV or, you know, or is
What do you mean continuity implants? Well, I haven't heard that term.
When you're doing these kind of, you know, these tie-ins to what's going on. I mean, World War Hulk is its event. You're coming
in. Oh,
I
see what you're saying.
Where you got, yeah, where this is my assumption. Some story beats are given to you. These things have to happen. But then go to town and write your own story.
Well, it was different for the two World War Hulk projects. For Iron Man, for instance, you see him in World War Hulk from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
So there were things that had to be included. I mean, you can't really, you know, do the story without showing Iron Man's fight with the Hulk, even though it's already been seen in World War Hulk number one, because there are going to be people, probably not many, but there are going to be people, and a couple of them have posted online, who only get Iron Man and aren't going to be picking up World War Hulk, and you have to have a... you know, understandable story for them to follow. So it would be a cheat not to show the fight. Having said that, you also want to put new stuff in the Iron Man issue that isn't just a rehash. So, you know, we put in the stuff with Iron Man's old suits of armor being used as space defenses and encountering the Hulk's ship in outer space.
Yep.
And we gave some insight into what Iron Man was thinking when he was fighting the Hulk. There was sort of a situation where it was like, here's some things that you need to include and need to work around.
Mm-hmm.
And then then you can do your own thing. With World War Hulk X-Men, it was basically, you know, this is going to be the X-Men's part in World War Hulk. So you can kind of do whatever you want, and we had it was convenient for me in that I said, how about if we set this entire thing during the 24-hour period that the Hulk gives everybody to evacuate Manhattan? Because, you know, let's say instead of just sitting up there on a stone ship, the Hulk was out there fighting the X-Men. So that's kind of what we did, and that one, there was, you know, a larger degree of freedom. It was two tie-ins that had sort of two different sets of circumstances because, like you said, the main miniseries is where it all happens, and you have to take that into consideration. So I don't know if I answered your question appropriately.
No, I was curious, yeah. Like, and just when you guys come in on an event like this, as opposed to just, you know, doing your own thing in your monthly, it's funny, World War Hulk was going to be one of those events I was going to blow off.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help it because it really is, in a lot of ways, a continuation of Civil War.
It is, and the thing that I think is great about World War Hulk is that it speaks to the fanboy in us all of, like, what would happen if so-and-so fought the Hulk, you know?
Sure.
And, I mean, what would happen if Ghost Rider fought the Hulk? What would happen if the X-Men fought the Hulk, you know? And so I think on some level it speaks to, like, the fanboy in all of us.
Oh, no question. Well, and also, it's as opposed to, like, Mark Evanier and Sergio Aragonés in a parody, like, the Hulk destroys the Marvel Universe. Mm-hmm. Well, now he's got a real reason to, and it's an
exactly.
interesting story.
There's some good character beats in there as well. And, you know, what I found interesting for me is when the Hulk was going up against the X-Men, this is an intelligent Hulk. I mean, he's not Bruce Banner smart, but he's smart.
Yes.
And when you're smart, you can be meaner than when you're stupid. So we actually, in World War Hulk X-Men 2, did you say you read it already or
yes,
not?
Yes, I did.
Huh?
Oh, yes, I did.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so you see how he handled Wolverine. You know, the Savage Hulk wouldn't have done that. I mean, basically, you know, spoiler alert here, but he holds Wolverine, he uses his reach. He holds Wolverine at arm's length, and while Wolverine is essentially carving away at his wrist, which is all he can get to, Hulk pounds him in the head again and again and again until his brain basically gets so scrambled that Wolverine is punch drunk and can't continue the fight, because Hulk is smart enough to know that Wolverine has a healing factor. He can't kill him. He can't just keep beating on him. You know, he's got to be smart about it. So that's what he did and took him out of the fight that way.
Yeah.
So that was fun for me because I got to depict the Hulk using strategy and not just, you know, Hulk smash pounding on stuff. So that was a lot of fun, actually.
Well, that's the cool thing. I think you're showing great grasp of all these characters in these little doses. You know, you had the Casualties of War thing with Iron Man and Cap, and it got into characterization. And Iron Man has been great too. I mean, that's
cool.
That's really cool, and I can see, and I who knows down the line. You know, I hope they tap you for one of these books because you're showing a clear love of the character, and I think you're putting them in fun situations and just adding to these events.
Well, I do love the characters, and you know, I think that you can respect their history without being a slave to it. I mean, you don't want to. You know, if you look at what Joss Whedon did with Astonishing X-Men, I mean, he didn't just come in and say, I'm going to ignore everything that came before. He acknowledged the Grant Morrison run. He acknowledged, you know, things that have happened, you know, in the past few years. But at the same time, he told it in a kind of way that if someone hasn't read X-Men for the past 20 years or ever, you know, let's say they were just a Buffy fan, they could come in and pick it up. And if they've only known the X-Men from the movies, they can pretty much follow who everybody is and what's going on. And that's kind of the ideal that, you know, that I try to do as well. I mean, you know, I'll throw in little continuity things for the longtime fan like myself who's been reading for 30 years. But at the same time, you want, you know, every comic book could be someone's first. So, you know, I think it's a fine line to walk, but I think it's possible to walk it and show, you know, how these things. I mean, the Cap Iron Man special was funny because Andy Schmidt called me up and, you know, was talking to me about the possibility of writing it. And, you know, I rattled off all these examples from their past about why I thought they would take the positions that they have. And Andy was like, basically, okay, you've got the job, you know, because just offhand, I knew all that stuff. And, you know, it was funny because I was at Heroes Con and someone asked me, a fan came up to get an autograph of that issue and said, so how long did it take you to research this issue? And I said, well, depends on how you look at it. Either no time at all or 30 years. So, you know, I've been reading the book for 30 years. What can I tell you?
Well, and then we see your work in the Wildstorm universe, and
yep.
I think, you know, it's funny. They made all the big announcements and all the big talent, and a lot of those big frontline Wildstorm books got delayed.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, you're chugging along with Stormwatch, and everyone falls in love with it. And honestly, I'm really pleased. It's the first trade, as you say, is out this week, and I really think it's been one of the pleasant surprises. And I think a lot of these, for lack of better words, second-tier Wildstorm books have been kind of carrying the torch, while the other books are kind of, you know, trying to get to issue two.
They have. I mean, I think that Gail's Welcome to Tranquility is the best work she's done, and I'm a huge fan of
me
her,
too,
so that's a high compliment coming from me. And I like what you're doing with Gen 13, and it's been very flattering to see people respond the way they have. I was reading an interview online with Patton Oswalt, who I've never met, and he was talking about what you just said. He said that he wasn't familiar with my work, and, you know, he picked up the Wildstorm relaunch and there were all these big names, and he's like, the one guy I never heard of was Chris Gage, and then he has, and I believe the quote was, the best-ass book. So I called up Ed Abernathy, my editor, and I said, that should be the pull quote for the second volume of Stormwatch, the best-ass book. But it would, no, it's very flattering, you know, that people like are paying attention and enjoying what they're reading, and a lot of it's been really flattering. A lot of pros have said the same thing to me, you know, and these are people who like get, you know, a box with every DC comic that comes out that month in it, and like they've said to me, you know, like Cully Hamner, you know, hey, great job. Howard Chaykin sent me an email saying how much he enjoyed, you know, Stormwatch and the Midnighter issue I did with John Paul Lee. And it's like, come on, this is Howard Chaykin saying this, you know. How can you not feel humbled by that? So, you know, I'm really happy, and I mean, we put a lot of love into it, and, you know, Ben's been working very hard as well, and, you know, I'm glad people are noticing. So.
How's the book doing? I mean, is it...
You know, sales aren't where we would like it to be. I think what we ran into, and this was something that kind of surprised me, actually, when people don't think of, like, the DC Universe or the Marvel Universe as one thing, because there's just too many books. If Action Comics is late, people don't say, well, I'm going to stop buying Detective Comics. But with Wildstorm Universe, because there's fewer books, I think people tend to look at it as a unit. Mm-hmm. And when Wildcats and the Authority were delayed, I think people lost faith in, not everybody, but there were retailers and fans who understandably, you know, lost some faith in the entire Wildstorm Universe line and sort of felt like, well, I'm not going to follow this, which is unfortunate because the books haven't really been interconnected. You know, you don't need to read any others to enjoy Tranquility or Stormwatch or,
absolutely,
you know, whatever the case may be, Gen 13. But at the same time, I understand the phenomenon. It's a fairly small line of books, and people look at it as one thing. So, I mean, if you look at from the debut to, say, issue 5 of every Wildstorm relaunch book, like the orders are about half of what they were when they started. So that's kind of a tough blow to recover from. So sales aren't where we would like them to be, but they're holding steady. The critical acclaim is strong. And like I said, the trade just came out. So that will, hopefully people will have, you know, gotten word on, you know, the critical acclaim for the series, and we'll pick up the trade and see what's going on with it. And as we've seen with the Vertigo model, it's entirely possible to, in a book on trade sales as its primary, you know, means of money making, even if the monthly sales aren't, you know, enough for the book to be profitable on its own.
For fans who haven't read Stormwatch yet and know you from your Marvel work, mm-hmm, why don't you take a moment and give them the 10-cent tour of Stormwatch?
Sure. Well, Stormwatch PhD is basically, the premise is that there's a group of people who are not necessarily superpowered themselves, although a couple of them are. But they are people with one foot in the normal human world and one foot in the superhuman world. Like, for a Marvel analog, like, if you could imagine, like, a task force that included, like, Rick Jones and Dr. Kurt Connors, who's the Lizard, you know, and people like that, like Dr. Strange's assistant Wong, if he was a hot chick, you know. you know, people like that on a police task force, and it's their job to figure out cost-effective ways to take down superhumans, in ways that are cost-effective and that can be replicated, like not, you know, bring me a $5 billion battle suit, you know. because when I was working on SVU and we were shooting and I was talking to real cops who were, you know, providing security for the set, I asked them, what's the difference, you know, what are the major differences between what you really do and what you see on these shows? And they said that one of the biggest differences was that, you know, you see all these amazing gadgets on shows like CSI, and they were like, those things may exist, but we can't afford them. You know, our budget does not allow us to have all those cool toys. So I thought that might be interesting, is to deal with the idea of a super team on a strained budget. So that's kind of what their deal is. They're trying to figure out how to take down superhuman threats using what's available to them, their specialized knowledge, sort of a MacGyver approach to it.
Absolutely. And that's really part of the fun, and also in the backdrop of a Powers or a Gotham Central.
Yeah,
and I think this book belongs in that kind of family. So yeah, I would say if you haven't checked out, you know, Stormwatch PhD,
and that's a very apt example. Gotham Central Powers. There's some Suicide Squad elements to it. You know, that those sorts of books. Yeah.
Catch up on the book. Absolutely. What issue are you on right now in the monthly?
We are up to issue 9. Just came out.
Let's go back to Marvel and talk about Quasar.
Okay.
And Annihilation. So what can you tell us about this miniseries?
Well, Quasar, like all the Annihilation miniseries, you can read it on its own or you can read it as part of the larger epic that is Annihilation. The Annihilation, this version is sort of Annihilation 2. It's called Annihilation Conquest. And the prologue already came out with some, great art by Mike Perkins, my old buddy from Union Jack.
Indeed.
Great story by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, who write Nova, the monthly series.
Mm-hmm.
And the Conquest event encompasses the prologue and then three miniseries, Quasar, Wraith, those two are already out, Star-Lord, and then the Nova monthly for four issues will be part of the Conquest event. But like I said, each individual one can be read on its own. And the premise is that we had the first Annihilation, which was a big intergalactic war. And in the aftermath of that, the Kree galaxy, the Kree are an alien race, and they are trying to sort of firm up security for their galaxy, mm-hmm. for their empire. There's a race called the Phalanx, which is a techno-organic race, which means that they're essentially robotic, machine intelligence. And they take advantage of this by infesting all the tech and essentially taking it over. And they take over the Kree Empire. They erect a barrier that literally cuts off the Kree Empire from the rest of the universe. And then they set about assimilating not just the technology, but the people. They can infect people with the techno-organic virus that turns them into computer, slaves of the Phalanx, essentially. Our books deal with the resistance forces against the Phalanx. And in Quasar, our editor, Bill Roseman, describes it as Joan of Arc in space, and that's an apt example because she, in the prologue, she heard the voice of what she assumes to be a higher power, telling her to find the savior of the Kree. So she and her lover Moondragon, a former Avenger, are yep. on a quest to find this mysterious savior of the Kree. So our book picks up on them setting out on their quest, and the chief antagonist is an old Avengers villain called the Super Adaptoid, who is part of the Phalanx. Tend to have technology-based and machine-based bad guys on their side. So the Super Adaptoid's on their side, and,
cool.
and he has the combined powers of all the Avengers, plus Captain Marvel, who is Quasar's father, who she never met, because she was conceived artificially. She's like a test tube baby after he died.
I gotcha.
I mean, all this sounds like a lot of backstory, but really, it's not too clunky.
No, not at all.
Easy for people to follow along. And so they're on this quest to find the Savior, and the Super Adaptoid is trying to stop them, and there are other subtle little things going on, like Moondragon is suffering from some mysterious ailment, and it's just a fun sort of sci-fi meets fantasy type of story. So
very cool.
I hope people enjoy it.
You know, again, interesting that there are so many events going on right now, and I think to their credit, all the events are doing okay. It seems the fear that I think a lot of fans had, when you go back to the 90s and how poorly events were ran,
yeah.
This era, so far, everything seems to be, for the most part, running pretty smoothly. Even if the event doesn't go well, the stories after the event seem to redeem whatever anybody didn't like about the original miniseries.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because for research for Quasar, I read the entire 60-issue run of the first of the Mark Gruenwald Quasar series.
Mm-hmm.
And for about the first 30, 35 issues, it was this great, fun, quirky series that went along and told its own story. And then it hit that period you're talking about when it seemed like a couple times every, 6 months there was a new crossover. And what happened, and in those days, you didn't have a choice if you were the creative team on a book as to whether you participated in a crossover. Like, every book that Marvel put out or DC put out was ordered to participate in this crossover. So what you would get is these sort of flimsy crossovers where the writer couldn't figure out a logical way or an important or necessary reason for this book to be crossing over, so they just kind of phone it in or tough it out until it was gone. So reading the run of Quasar, what would happen, after about issue 35 for me is, all of a sudden a crossover would happen. So for three or four issues, it would be sort of, filling time. And then for about three or four issues, it would go back to the book's own storylines and the plot threads that it had left dangling. And then another crossover would come in. So it got really frustrating and annoying. And like you said, they were all pretty bad because they were fairly flimsy and there wasn't a lot of justification for the crossovers. Today what happens is, I believe this is the case, generally speaking at both companies, at least has been in my experience, that the creators have a choice as to whether they want to participate. in the crossover. Like with Civil War, Ed Brubaker had the Cap in London storyline going on, so no one said, no, you have to cut this short. He played that story out, and then Cap's, we started seeing, you know, Cap's involvement in Civil War within that pages of that book. And other books had, you know, nothing to do with Civil War. The Annihilation event, as you pointed out, was totally separate from Civil War. And it was its own thing, and they both did very well. I mean, obviously Annihilation didn't sell in Civil War numbers, but these were all characters that had been previously thought, they were Marvel Cosmic characters that everyone thought couldn't sell books.
Mm-hmm.
But Andy Schmidt had the idea of creating an event around them with a series of miniseries, and it sold very well for these characters. It didn't sell 100,000 copies, but it sold a lot more than anyone thought, and as a result of that, we now have a Nova ongoing series. So it showed that there's a market for these cosmic books, and, you know, here we are doing it again with Annihilation too. So I think it's all in the execution. I mean, nothing, you know, crossovers aren't inherently bad. You know, nothing is inherently bad if it's done, you know, at the end of the day, everything is justified if it's good.
Sure.
If it's done well, then it was a good idea. If it's done badly, it was a bad idea.
Bill Roseman has always been a guy that has presented a good public face for Marvel and a public face for CrossGen when he was the marketing guy there.
Yeah.
How is it working with him as an editor?
I love working with Bill. I mean, Bill is one of the, his personality, he's one of the most excitable guys, and I mean that in a good way, not like irascible. I mean, he's excited. He's genuinely excited about everything. It was funny because Andy Schmidt said, posted online somewhere, because Bill inherited the reins of the Annihilation books from Andy.
Mm-hmm.
And Andy, at the time, was expecting a baby. He and his wife have since had their baby. And as you know, Andy stepped out from Marvel to stay at home with the baby. He said, Bill is more excited about Annihilation than I am about having a baby. And he didn't mean that he wasn't excited about having a baby. He just meant that Bill is so naturally excited and excitable about what he's doing. He just really gets into it, and he loves it. And he, you know, that rubs off. That can't help but rub off on the creative people. You know, not that Bill's not part of the creative team, he is, but you know, the artist and the writer.
Sure.
It can't help but rub off, and you get excited about it too, and you want to do your best work because, you know, you don't want to disappoint him.
That's very cool.
So, and it's all true. I mean, that's not Bill's public image, you know, just trying to sell books. I mean, he genuinely means what he's saying when you see him on the panels, and he's so excited.
Well, and he backs it up. I mean, he's always been a very knowledgeable guy about the things that he's promoting, and that's the thing. He has been able to communicate, hey, you need to read this book because X, Y, and Z. And yeah, I mean, I think he delivers the message, but it's always based in truth because he is a fan.
He is, and at the same time, he's also not afraid to innovate. Like, if you'll notice on these books, the covers, which are beautiful,
yes,
they're not done by names that comic fans are necessarily familiar with. Bill went out to the worlds of, you know, video games and role-playing games and things like that, and got painters and artists who are veterans who have been doing this a while and know what they're doing, but haven't worked in comics before. And he said, hey, some of these guys really kind of think outside the box of what we're used to in comics, you know? I mean, comics, rightfully so, sci-fi comics, are tremendously influenced by the likes of Jack Kirby and Wally Wood, and they should be. But at the same time, it's interesting to get a little H.R. Giger in there. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, you know, or a little bit of something else, you know. So Bill went out and found some guys who were working in other fields and said, hey, how'd you like to give this a try? And I think it's turned out great. I mean, the covers are really, really beautiful. So,
where did Matt Wilson come from?
You know, you would have to ask Bill that.
All right, sorry.
I believe he's from the video game world, but I don't want to commit myself to that because I could totally be wrong. But I love the covers. I mean, you know, the first issue is very iconic. It sort of totally gets across that, you know, sci-fi mixed with fantasy vibe. And,
oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, half Jedi, half Lord of the Rings. This is a very cool cover.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to ask about Union Jack, and I'm glad you mentioned Perkins, because I know you guys are getting together for House of M.
Yes.
How well did the trade do? I mean, is it possible you guys might come back with the Union Jack series? Because that miniseries was great.
I haven't heard. Thank you very much. The trade came out just on July 4th, actually. I haven't heard anything about the numbers. I mean,
it seems
to have been well received, just like the series was well received. I know we're reuniting for House of M, and of course Mike is you know, one of the two regular artists on Captain America. And as far as us reuniting for Union Jack, I don't know if that's in the cards, but I believe that because of the positive reaction, Union Jack may be playing a more high-profile role in the Marvel Universe in the near future. I don't want to say too much,
sure.
You know, without
away. We're close to convention season, I understand.
Yeah, this is true. Well, I don't know if anything... I don't know when it'll be announced, and I'm not even sure. I just heard some rumbling. I'm not directly involved, so I just hear things. But
okay.
I think he might be more involved. I mean, he was in the last issue of Fallen Sun. And I think he will be... I think because of the way the miniseries was well received, that there is some interest in Marvel at bringing him in more. So I hate to sound like I'm being coy, but that's all I'm going to say right now. And I know
Mike
and I would both love to get back to the character, but we both got very full plates right now.
Well, let's focus on this House of M thing coming up, because
yes.
I'm glad you guys are back together again. You're a good team, and
we're putting the band back together.
Yay! That's fantastic. And focusing on some great street-level characters beyond Luke Cage and Iron Fist. I love the Sons of the Dragon. And
yeah.
I did you read those great black and white Deadly Hands of Kung Fu stories?
Of course I did.
Cheese at its best, but really, it really is. It was one of my favorite throwaway Marvel series of the 70s.
Oh, yeah, it was great. George Perez got his Marvel start there, I believe.
That's right.
And, you know.
Bill Mantlo, I want to say, was one of those guys?
No, it was great stuff. And those are the characters there that are very close to both me and Mike. And it's funny because the way Mike described it for him is that he was living in England, and the American comics that would make their way over there tended to be sort of the B-list titles.
Uh-huh.
So he would end up with like Invaders and Deadly Hands of Kung Fu rather than Spider-Man and Hulk and Captain America. So those are the characters he feels really close to. So we're just having a blast, and you know, it covers the miniseries itself tells kind of the history of the House of M world. It covers probably 20 to 25 years. Because in the original House of M miniseries, Brian Bendis set the date of 1979 for the end of the Human Mutant War. So we're the way it was established in the, I believe it was the Secrets of the House of M handbook, was that Luke Cage got his powers when he was part of a prison experiment designed to produce super soldiers who could compete with the superpowers of the mutants in the Human Mutant War. So based on that, he got his powers in 1979. So I was like, great. You know, that gives us a logical reason to have him in his yellow shirt and everything else.
And the tiara.
The tiara, yeah. And it's funny because I was on the fence about the tiara, but Mike wanted the tiara. He really wanted the tiara.
Good.
So we got the tiara. You know, we're showing everybody like Hawkeye in the skirt, and you know, everybody in their old school costumes, for better or worse, as the case may be. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, we're just having a blast with it. I just recently wrote the second issue, and you know, it's great to be able to write these characters. You know, there's Moon Knight's in there, Tigra, Iron Fist, as you pointed out, and the villains I think will surprise some people. The villains include there's an FBI. These guys don't come in until the second issue, but there's an FBI task force that's led by Thunderbird, who the X-Men who died in X-Men 95,
mm-hmm.
Uncanny X-Men 95, and in this world he's a FBI agent. And he's got this team of mutant operatives who are out to crush Luke Cage and his freedom fighters, and they include like the Blob and Taskmaster, who's not really a mutant, he's just passing. But then they have a token human on the team, and that's Frank Castle, the Punisher. So he's on the team, and it's interesting to get into his character, because in the House of M world, the conceit there is that your fondest wish comes true, but there's usually some type of strings attached. Like for Spider-Man, Gwen Stacy was alive, and he was married to her, and they had a kid, and everybody loved him, unlike in our world where
yep.
people think he's a menace. But the strings attached was that he had to hide the fact that he wasn't a mutant, and that could come out at any moment and ruin his life. So with the Punisher, what it is he was able to save his family from being killed. And as a result of that incident, he's recruited into this task force as sort of the token human. But the strings attached is that if he decides that these guys he's working with are operating a little bit too rough, and you know, he's not crazy about what they're doing, well, guess what? Now he's got a family that they can threaten to keep him in line. So, you
wow.
know, it's been fun sort of getting into that whole thing.
That's really cool.
And just thinking about, like, what would Punisher be like if his family hadn't been killed? Well, obviously he'd still be a badass. I mean, he was a Marine in Vietnam.
Yep.
But would he be quite so hardcore? Would he be quite so obsessed? You know, would he be quite so ruthless? And just asking myself and answering those questions is really fun. I mean, I love these kinds of stories.
Were you a fan of Stephen Grant and all the various great Marvel writers that have written The Punisher in the last, you know, couple decades?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that Mike Zeck Punisher, Stephen Grant Mike Zeck Punisher miniseries was fantastic.
Yeah.
I was thrilled when Mike ended up doing the cover. Mike and Jerry Ordway did the cover for Deadshot.
Oh, that's right.
That was my first
absolutely
first comic book series. So.
And yeah, Deadshot continues to hop along merrily, and I hope DC gives you the chance to get back to him sometime soon.
I hope so, too. But right now he's in the capable hands of John Ostrander, who
indeed
really sort of didn't create the character, but gave him, made him who he is, and so I'm perfectly happy to let John. I mean, I want to. I'm desperate to read the book.
Yeah, that's going to be great. No, yeah. No kidding. Yeah, and I got to talk to John about that. That's going to be fantastic.
Well, tell him I'm really looking forward to it.
Cool. The and let's get back to Wildstorm then, because
okay,
you've got two things coming up. More Midnighter work?
Yeah. Well, there's been a little bit of a, I think, a mistake in the solicit. There's a miniseries that I'm writing called Armageddon. It's 6 issues, and each issue spotlights a different character or team from the Wildstorm universe. The first one is spotlights the Midnighter, and to a lesser degree, the Authority. So there have been reports online that say that it's a Midnighter miniseries, but actually it's Armageddon is the miniseries, and each one is its own sort of self-contained story spotlighting a different Wildstorm character. So the first issue is the Midnighter, and the premise is that in each issue, a given character will be pulled from the present into the future by Void from the Wildcats to lay eyes on a post-apocalyptic future and see what's become of the Wildstorm universe at that time.
Okay.
And hopefully gain the information they need to go back in time and stop it from happening. Now, this isn't a new story. We've all seen it before, from the Terminator to Days of Future Past, et cetera, et cetera. But the fun thing about the Wildstorm universe is it's all about breaking rules. You know, you can do things that you wouldn't be able to do or wouldn't want to see done in the Marvel or DC universes, where, you know, the characters are icons who have been around for 40, 50, 60 years. So in our universe, you know, when Midnighter goes forward into the future and sees that the carrier has crashed on London and, you know, his teammates have been, you know, affected in various ways, some of them pretty devastating, you don't know for sure that that's not going to come to pass, you know. And this one thing I will guarantee is this isn't going to be one of those storylines where you go forward, you see a post-apocalyptic future, you come back, stop it, and nothing, you know, there are no consequences.
They hit the reset button, yeah.
Yeah, there will be consequences from this. So, just fair warning. And each issue is illustrated by a different artist. The first, the Midnighter one, is by Simon Colby, who's done some great work for 2000 AD. He's worked for Marvel before, and I believe DC, and his stuff is really great. It's got a nice edge to it. I think people will like it. And I don't think I'm allowed to talk about the other issues yet.
Okay.
But there are 5 more issues.
Very cool. So is this different from the Authority run I've been hearing about for you?
It is different, yes. The Authority run is called Authority Prime, and it's an arc I'm doing with Derek Robertson, who I'm really thrilled to be working with. And that one takes place in the current, in the present day. And the premise of that one is that when Henry Bendix was this insane genius who founded Stormwatch and created Apollo and Midnighter from the Authority and had a lot to do with the creation of both teams, and he's dead, but he had this thing called the Memory Tower, which was an encrypted thing where all his deadliest secrets were hidden inside, and Stormwatch uncovers the location of a secret underground bunker belonging to Bendix. So they want to go find out what's inside because they know it could be something very beneficial to the world or something very deadly or both. However, the Authority, who have been monitoring the situation as well, don't want Stormwatch to have it because Stormwatch is now an agency of the U.S. government. And as we all know, the Authority's had its problems with the U.S. government. So Stormwatch and the Authority end up at odds, and it's kind of like a family feud, as it were, because the Authority grew out of Stormwatch, and many of the characters used to be teammates and friends. So it's, you know, it's really kind of interesting from both a character and an action standpoint. You get to see these two teams fight, but also there's some interesting and poignant character stuff going on.
Cool.
And Derek's just drawing the hell out of it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And will it be a separate miniseries or will it be within the Authority run?
Originally it was going to be part of the Authority run, and then basically Derek had an issue in the can and Wildstorm figured, you know what, instead of either putting it into the middle of the unfinished Grant Morrison Gene Ha run, or further delaying, you know, the book when there's no reason to delay it, let's just put it out as its own miniseries. So it's called Authority Prime.
Cool.
And it starts up in November.
Excellent.
Yep.
And the big news last week, man, Dynamite, the man with no name.
Yes, man with no name. That was an exciting one, and that's something that I've been talking to Nick Barucci about for the past couple of months, I would say. And
how'd you get the gig?
Well, Nick and I have been talking just in a general sense about. I was contacted by Joe, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, Joe Ribant over there.
Okay.
And he said, you know, we really like your stuff. Would you like to do something for us? And I said, oh, I'm awfully busy. And he said, how about an 8-page Red Sonja story for Savage Tales? And we'll get Joyce Chin to draw it. And I think Joyce is terrific, and I'm a big Red Sonja fan, so I said, sure, I could do 8 pages. So I did it, and they really liked it. And it's coming out in Savage Tales number 3.
Cool.
And, you know, I met Nick, and Nick was like, you know, really love your stuff. We enjoyed working with you. Let's talk about what else we can do. And so we met up in New York at the Comic-Con and talked on the phone, and he was mentioning some of the properties that they have and were in the process of getting, and he mentioned Man with No Name, and I said, that's the one I want to do. And he said, well, you know, when would you be available to write it? And I told him, and he said, we kind of were hoping for something sooner than that. And he said, but, you know, I think you're the guy for this. You know, let me see what I can do and, you know, see what we can massage the schedule or whatever. And, you know, long story short, we both kind of felt like there was a chemistry there that, you know, this was, he felt I was the right writer and I felt this was the right book, at least the one I really wanted to do. And it all came together from there. And MGM approved me as the writer. They approved the pitch. So off we go. I just need to start writing it and try not to be horribly intimidated by the the prospect of, you know, taking this iconic character and translating him to comics and, you know, not having people look at it and say, oh, my God, this is horrible. You, sir, are no Sergio Leone.
Or the prospect of an 85-year-old Clint Eastwood finding you and kicking your ass.
Well, you know, he probably could kick my ass if he wanted to. But, MGM owns it, so.
Well, I understand. You know, it's funny. Chuck Dixon told me last year, and it's interesting that MGM is really the sole arbiter of what happens with the character, because Dixon said DC approached Warner Brothers about a Batman Dirty Harry crossover.
Uh-huh.
And Eastwood turned it down.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure he probably has.
Yeah, you know, no way.
Equity in that type of thing. And, well, his deal, I believe, is still at Warner Brothers, for one thing. So, you know, Warner Brothers is going to do what he says. But also, you know, when he made the Dirty Harry movie, he was a big star.
Sure.
And probably had some say in what happens. I believe when he made the you know, Man with No Name films, I mean, he was a star. He had been on
Rawhide,
and, you know, he was well known, but he wasn't, you know, to use today's standards, I mean, you know, he wasn't like a you know, Tom Hanks.
Oh, no, he wasn't bankable box office. He was
right.
he was a TV star going to look for work other than TV.
Right, exactly.
So,
I mean, I don't know. Maybe Clint will come after me, but, you know, that would just be so cool to, you know, Clint Eastwood just kick my ass, you know? And I'd be really happy about that.
Well, tell me about, you know, obviously you're a fan of the films. I mean, tell me about the appeal for you for The Man with No Name.
Well, he's an iconic character. You know, the analogy I used is basically that he may not have been the first anti-hero, but every anti-hero that came after was influenced by him. It's kind of like there were sci-fi movies before Star Wars, and after Star Wars there have been sci-fi movies that are very different, but after Star Wars, even the movies that are incredibly different can't help but be influenced just by being aware of Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So this is just such an iconic character, and, you know, I really enjoy the Western genre, and there's actually, you know, I mean, there's such a, when I say a mythology, it's almost like an archetypal quality to the character. I mean, there are continuity-oriented mythologies more in terms of some of the other characters, like, you know, we love to tell the story of how he first met Tuco and Tuco Ramirez and Angel Eyes and, you know, things like that.
Yep.
But at the same time, there's this mythological quality about the character. You know, he comes in, like, you're not going to see a story about the man with no name setting up a barbershop in a town, you know? He drifts into town, kicks some ass and drifts out. You know, he's almost this ethereal, magical character, and you know, he's an archetype. You know, just like all the greatest, you know, Superman's an archetype. I mean,
sure.
Batman's an archetype, you know?
Well, it's nice seeing Westerns in the hands of today's creators, because even back in the 70s and 60s, and certainly even the 50s and everything, there are moments of real quality, certainly in art, but even in storytelling as well. But now, comic book stories are allowed to breathe in a way that they weren't back then. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
which you need for anything that's going to remotely resemble a Leone film.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the excitement of seeing Westerns now. It's funny, I was just telling someone, because they made the announcement on the Miller board. They announced that, you know, you got the gig.
Mm-hmm.
And someone asked, do comic book fans read Westerns? And I'm like, oh my God, if you're not reading Jonah Hex right now, you don't know what you're missing. And
Jonah
Loveless.
Hex is fantastic.
And Azzarello's doing an amazing job on Loveless.
Yeah.
And I loved also Tex.
And Lone Ranger.
Well, yes, I don't mean to deny Dynamite for Cassidy and, is it Brenda Jirwa that's writing Lone Ranger? No, it's
Brett Matthews.
Brett Matthews, excuse me. And Brett's doing a good job. I love the free comic.
Is that the Joe Kubert thing?
Yes, he drew it, but it's an old Italian Western character.
Right.
That, yeah, SAS released this wonderful collection of Kubert, like 256 pages of story.
Yeah.
And it's just so great to see.
Overseas, the Western as a genre is much stronger than it is here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that it's not strong here, but it's stronger. Howard Chaykin did a original graphic novel, it's a Western, I believe, for the Italian market.
That's right.
Last time I saw him, he was showing it to me, and I was like, damn, I wish I could actually read this. You know, I wish I knew what they were saying. You know,
Dan Brereton and I were talking about that last night. You're absolutely right.
So, yeah. You know, I mean, it's great that the Western is back, and you know, it's great that there are good Westerns. I mean, Jonah Hex was always a great book, in my opinion. I've read the entire run, and it was always fantastic, and it's still fantastic. Jimmy and Justin are doing an absolutely amazing job, and, you know, Lone Ranger is a terrific book, and, you know, I think as long as there are good Westerns out there, there will be a market for them, I think.
Have they announced your artist?
They have not. And I'm not at liberty to say anything
okay.
about that.
No problem, man. Well, what's going on with you non-comic book-wise? Or is all this comic book work keeping you busy from doing anything with TV or movies right now?
All the comic book work is taking up a lot of time. However, there is some stuff in the offing. Well, my wife Ruth and I, Ruth is my writing partner on
mm-hmm.
the screenwriting stuff. We wrote an independent film which has a director named Peter Askin attached, a well-known theater director who also directed a film called Company Man. And we actually wrote that for Jeanette Kahn's company, production company, Jeanette Kahn, the former publisher of DC.
Mm-hmm.
And we also are adapting a couple of scripts of ours into graphic novels, original graphic novels, with an eye towards, you know, retaining ownership of the material rather than sending out a spec script and if someone buys it, then you give up all rights to it. It's actually... being involved in comics is great because now, you know, you can come out with something original that you have an ownership stake in. So, you know, there's some... I'm sorry to be coy, but some of this, you know...
No problem.
...is going to be announced in the future. But, yeah, there's always non-comics work going on. It will continue to go on. I'm just not at liberty to say.
No sweat, man. Well, that's cool. Man, I just looked up Company Man in IMDb. That sounds like a cool movie.
Yeah, the director, Peter's a great guy, and it's a really fun film, not comic book oriented. There's some magic to it, but it's not in the comic book vein at all. It's almost more of like a, I'm trying to think, did you see the movie Big Fish?
Yes.
It's a bit like, it's kind of like that. They're in the process of putting together the financing for it, and, you know, knock on wood, it'll be going into production before too long. So
very cool.
That we will look forward to that.
Are we going to see you in San Diego or Chicago?
Oh, yeah, I'm at San Diego. I'm one of their featured guests, actually, this year.
Excellent.
So I will be there for the duration.
What panels do you have?
I have, I have Spotlight on Chris Gage, which makes me very nervous.
Who's going to be moderating that for you?
That's Ben Abernathy.
Oh, very cool.
My Stormwatch editor.
Excellent.
And we are both terrified at the prospect of being up there with the lights on us. So the appeal is, anyone who's listening, please show up just for no other reason than to see which of us sweats more. But no, that's going to be a fun panel. Ben and I are good friends, and we're going to talk and answer questions and have fun, and whoever shows up might get an advance, you know, news on something that we weren't supposed to say.
Very cool.
And I'm on the Wildstorm panel, of course. I am on a panel called From Script to Screen, which has other quote-unquote crossover people on it, like Greg Rucka, Cecil Castellucci, and Oh, and there's the GameTap panel. Yeah, I haven't talked about this. I collaborated with Jim Lee on a webisode, a five-minute webisode that's featuring Lara Croft Tomb Raider. And that's for a website called GameTap, which is basically a game portal.
Mm-hmm.
But they're starting to commission their own original content. And they did something called Lara Croft Tomb Raider Revision, which is basically 10 webisodes animated, created by comic book and animation talent, like Warren Ellis and Cully Hamner did one, Gail Simone, and gosh, I can't remember who designed that one with her, but Gail did one. The guy who created Aeon Flux did one.
So, wow.
And then they approached Jim and Jim Lee, and Jim wanted to collaborate with me on it, which I was very honored to do. So Jim Lee and I did, I believe it's the last one there, and it comes out October 23rd, but there's going to be some previews at Comic-Con at the GameTap panel. So that's very exciting.
That's
and
really
Minnie
cool.
Driver does the voice of Lara Croft, which is great. It's terrific.
That's cool. Did you get to meet her?
I did not.
Bummer.
But,
hot.
I used to see her all the time when I worked out at this gym over on Cole Avenue.
Okay.
I mean,
wow.
We're talking like several years ago. But she used to come in all the time and walk on the treadmill. So I've seen her. I've never met her.
Wow, man. Like, what are your regular celebrity sightings being out in L.A.? I mean, obviously, it's no big deal being there.
I don't go... You know, it's funny because my wife and I are both real homebodies. We do know some celebrities. Like, there's some, like, Gene Triplehorn is a friend.
Oh, that's cool. You know all the hotties. Nice going.
Well, I'm a happily married man.
I'm sorry, sir.
What you're implying there, sir. And her husband, Leland Orser, is a good friend, and he's on ER. And
not as hot as Genie, but okay.
No, he's not. Well, you know, it depends how you dress him up. No,
okay.
But no, Gene is, they're both wonderful people.
Very cool.
And Ruth, my wife, has known Charles Dutton. He was on a show called Rock.
Excellent actor, wonderful character actor. Big fan, absolutely.
Great, and a great director, Emmy-winning director.
That's right.
We've known him for a long time. Ruth has known him longer than she's known me, actually, and he's a great guy. He spends a lot of his time out in the Maryland area where he's from. So, you know, it's funny because you hear about all the crazy tabloid stuff, but the people we know tend to be very normal, down-to-earth type people. Not that there aren't crazy people out there, but we don't know them. We don't move in the same circles, as it were. You're not gonna catch Ruth and me out at, I don't even know what the clubs are these days. I was Dragonfly at 2 a.m. on a Friday night. Dragonfly is probably a club from like 8 years ago. That shows how current we are with the... But as for celebrity sightings, I mean, you can't live around here without seeing people, but, you know, it gets to be...
Jimmy Smits is mowing his lawn, look!
Yeah. Now, well, we live around the corner from a dessert and pastry shop that a lot of celebrities go to, and I'll go in there craving some chocolate, and, you know, somebody will be there from movies or TV. But the funniest thing that happens is you'll be in the grocery store, and you'll see somebody, and they look familiar to you, and you get really embarrassed because you think you've met them somewhere and just forgot their name or who they are. And then, like, you're trying to, like, avoid them and remember who they are in case they see you. And then you realize, like, you saw them on a commercial or something. You know? So, I mean, you want to go, I mean, I stopped this years ago, but you go up to someone, now, did I go to high school with you? You know, it's like, no.
No, I was a sweat hog.
Yeah. And then you do, you know, like, I've seen Julie Strain at the supermarket in her sweatpants and sweatshirt, you know, and, you know, like, there are ones you do recognize, but,
sure.
You know, a lot of the times it's like, gosh, I wish I could place where I knew that person. You know, should I be embarrassed or should I not be embarrassed?
Well, dude, listen, I appreciate the time because I always enjoy your books and enjoy talking to you.
Well, so the feeling is mutual.
Thank you, and continued success and enjoying what's out on the racks, and look forward to what's coming up in the fall and in the winter.
Thanks very much, sir.
That's Chris Gage. I have a feeling he's going to have more announcements coming at San Diego and maybe at Wizard Chicago. But in the meantime, lots to pick up on the racks. Go out there and get the Stormwatch PhD trade from Wildstorm and the Union Jack trade from Marvel. Be on the lookout for Iron Man's World War Hulk tie-in next week and catch the other issues of the X-Men tie-in as well. And later this year, Marvel's House of M and Dynamite's Man With No Name, among others. Chris wants you to know that you can stay on top of his upcoming projects by visiting his website, ChristosGage.com. ChristosGage.com. This episode of Word Balloon is sponsored by MailOrderComics.com, today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you've liked them before, Check them out today. They've got all new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic book and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% or more. For all the details, go to mailordercomics.com. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, Word Balloon is all over the internet. We're at newsarama.com. We're available at iTunes. You can do a search for Word Balloon and we'll pop up. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed, either there or at our Libsyn blog, which is wordballoon.libsyn.com. We're at myspace.com/wordballoon, comicspace.com/wordballoon, and of course all the various podcatcher and podcast alley sites that you can think of. Any questions or comments on the show, I can always be reached via email, john@wordballoon.com. In the meantime, thanks for listening. This is John Suntress. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007, all rights reserved.